If you've got the sniffles, do you go to the doctor or to the clinic at the pharmacy? This is Shots, health news from NPR.
Everybody.
Hi, I'm Scott Hensley. At retail clinics, you can just walk right in and get medical care. No appointment needed. You'll find them inside CVS, Target, and Walmart. And it turns out, people love them. Also on this podcast, we'll try to figure out if there's any link between multivitamins and cancer. We'll have a great chat with a Harvard researcher about the unintended consequences of raiding doctors, and NPR's Julie Rovner will stop by. Here we go. Hi, this is Scott Hensley. I'm standing outside a walk-in clinic, a retail health clinic on 14th Street in Washington, D.C., and we are here because NPR, in partnership with Truven Health, recently did a poll asking people around the country what they thought about these retail clinics. They seem to be popping up everywhere. And we thought we'd come to the streets today and ask people here in Washington what they think. Could you tell me your name and your age, if you're willing to disclose it?
Sure. My name's Claire Robertson, and I'm 26.
And what do you do here in Washington?
I'm a student.
Great. Have you ever been to a retail clinic?
No, I have not.
How come?
Because I've always been covered by other medical insurance. I guess I've always just seen physicians at sort of private practice cares and stuff. Yeah.
Do you have a regular primary care doctor or a nurse practitioner who you see?
I do. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you want to hear what we found out in our poll?
Yeah, I would love to.
Okay. So we asked 3,000 Americans from coast to coast mm-hmm. about retail clinics, what they thought of them. So first off, we said, are you aware of the clinics in the community where you live?
Sure.
Half said yes, half said they weren't aware that there was one.
Yeah, I feel like I would fall in that camp
okay.
as well.
So you're in good company. Yeah. So then we asked both the people who were aware and those who weren't, mm-hmm. well, would you be willing to use one if there was one?
Yeah.
And it came out about the same. Two-thirds of people said, sure, I'd be willing to do it.
Okay.
And then we asked people who had used one, well, how'd it go?
Yeah.
And overwhelmingly, people were positive about the experience. 80% of the people who had used a clinic were either very satisfied or satisfied
sure.
with the experience. Now, what do you think they went to the clinic for?
I would assume some kind of immediate care if you're, you know, have the flu or something like that, but I don't know.
She has the right answer.
Yeah.
So, in fact, the most common reason that people went was because they had a minor illness, like a cold or the flu. A lot of people, and let's be honest, it was older people, 65 and up, a big reason that they went to the clinics was to get their flu shot.
That makes sense, yeah.
But we also found out that younger people went for other immunizations, mm-hmm. and some got flu shots, but not so many in your demographic.
Yeah. Exactly. Fair enough.
And we had the good fortune to meet up with Michael Jackson, who works in the neighborhood. No, not that Michael Jackson.
Can you spell it the way the other guy did?
No, that's the way he's spelling the way I did. Well, you better stop, man.
Have you ever used a retail health
clinic like this one? This is my first time even knowing it was there.
Really?
Honestly. Do they take insurance here?
Some do and some don't.
Okay.
So we asked people about that, people who had been to the clinics, how much it had cost you. So most of the people who had insurance, their insurance paid for most of it. For the people who had to pay a copay, something out of their pocket, it ran around $25 or less. For people who don't have insurance, you can just pay cash on the barrelhead for whatever they charge. They have a fee list for the different things that they do.
I may come and visit that one. Really?
Now, would it matter to you if it were a nurse practitioner versus a doctor? Now, the nurse could write a prescription.
As well as a doctor could.
Yeah.
I think it wouldn't really matter, as long as she treated me like a human being, like a patient, and not like a number, you know? So that's what I think I would choose them all.
We didn't find anybody today who had used one of the retail clinics that we had in mind, but both people we talked to were open to the idea of it, which was in line with what we found in talking with Americans across the country. Did you see the headlines that said taking a multivitamin could reduce your risk of cancer? Even if you didn't notice, the maker of Centrum Silver, Pfizer, sure did.
Then I heard this news about a multivitamin study looking at long-term health benefits for men over 50. And the multivitamin they used for the study? Centrum Silver. Hey, that's what I take.
So what did the study find? Well, the absolute reduction in risk for developing cancer for men taking the vitamins rather than a sugar pill was just a smidge over 1%. The findings met the statistical test for what researchers say is significant, but should you care? So I was looking for some help with this one, and I called Steven Salzberg, who's a researcher at Johns Hopkins, who also writes for Forbes. And he does a lot for the popular press, debunking or trying to get behind some of the science headlines.
I'm still skeptical. The effect was very small. I can't really say from the study that it's not a real effect. But when you have a small effect that's observed like this, it's possible just by chance that the men who were in the vitamin arm somehow were just a little healthier.
One of the things that Salzberg pointed out is that even in a study like this one, where everybody did everything right, and the statisticians were happy, and the editors of the Journal of the American Medical Association were happy, is that it could have been a fluke. It's possible that there was some undetected difference between the groups. There's a chance, 1 in 20, 1 in 25, that the study looks right but is wrong.
And there were a couple of very large studies just last year that indicated that daily vitamins could actually be bad for you. The way I look at it in the context of multiple studies is, let's suppose there's no effect. Some of the studies, or most of them, would show no effect, but we would expect a small percentage of studies to show a positive link between vitamins and cancer. We'd also expect some studies to show a negative link, that is, that vitamins would be more likely to cause cancer or to be associated with cancer. And that's kind of what we're seeing.
It's very rare that one study will give the answer on any given problem. In fact, last year, a study of women taking vitamins found that they hurt.
This new study finds certain supplements may increase an older woman's risk of dying. And that's
another study last year of men taking vitamin E found that it increased the risk of prostate cancer rather than lowering it.
The finding shocked the medical community.
So what does Salzberg do?
I'm not taking a multivitamin myself, and I'm not planning to start.
So would it help you to do it? Probably not. Would it hurt you? Also probably not. But making a decision on this one study is also probably not the greatest idea. Earlier this year, I met a doctor who explained health report cards in a way that finally helped me understand them.
So my name is Ashish Jha, and I'm an associate professor of health policy at the Harvard School of Public Health.
Now, these health report cards are quality ratings that are supposed to help patients and their families decide who the best doctors are and which hospitals are the best for them to go to for care. I was looking for an excuse to talk to Ashish again, and I found it in a paper that he and some colleagues put out on a surprising and unintended effect of these public report cards.
So, you know, we were interested in understanding what happens to doctors' decision-making once they're having their performance be publicly reported. And what we found is that for patients who have heart attacks, patients who really can benefit from angioplasty, this procedure that opens up their heart vessels, for these patients, they were actually less likely to get this life-saving therapy when the doctors were being rated. And this was disturbing because this is an important treatment for heart attack patients. It can be life-saving. And while I believe that we should have accountability for doctors, and I believe that that information should be available to consumers, one of the side effects is that it's making doctors gun-shy. It's making them avoid taking care of the very sickest patients, the people who actually benefit the most from these procedures.
And let's be clear here. The issue for a doctor would be if too many patients who he treated died, that his rating would look bad, and that would be in the public domain, and people might say, well, Dr. X isn't doing a good job. I don't want to go to him.
Exactly. So, you know, the rating says this percentage of your patients died or had a complication after the procedure. And of course, we know that some doctors take care of very, very sick patients, and other doctors, their patients are not quite as sick. And what we want to make sure is that we don't penalize doctors who take care of sicker patients, because they're actually often the very best doctors. And so there is an effort to deal with that. They do what's called risk adjustment, where they try to account for how sick the patients are. But our study basically says that the doctors weren't convinced that the risk adjustment was good enough. And so they were worried that the ratings would make them look bad and therefore held off on doing the procedure in some subset of very sick patients.
And what were the consequences of that?
So what we found was that there was a trend. Now, it wasn't statistically significant, but it looked like in states that had public reporting, it looked like mortality rates were heading in the wrong direction, that mortality rates were going up for heart attack patients because they were less likely to get these life-saving procedures.
What's the action to remedy that problem? Or should we just say ratings are flawed and we won't be able to use them quite the way that we expected?
So I think the wrong reaction would be to say, no, we shouldn't do ratings at all. Because I actually firmly believe that ratings are very helpful. They help doctors get better. They help patients have information that patients have a right to have. So what we need to do is we need to figure out how to do these ratings better. We need to do a better job of risk adjustment. We need to come up with a strategy that really reassures doctors that taking care of the sickest patients won't unfairly penalize them. And this says we just haven't quite gotten there yet.
Well, maybe this would be the time to take a look at what the ratings are that are out there now. What would you say is the state of the art of ratings out there right now?
Yeah, so, you know, 5 years ago, we were in a situation where there was almost no information for patients and consumers. If you wanted to know how good a hospital was, it was almost impossible to tell. That has really changed in the last 5-7 years. And there has been this proliferation of ratings, by private companies, by Medicare, by nonprofit organizations like the Leapfrog Group. All of them trying to rate some aspect of hospital care. And the problem is we now have so many, and I actually believe there will be more yet coming, that in fact you may have too many for consumers, and it may cause a lot of confusion in the marketplace, because what you're going to have is you look at 8 different ratings that all rate your hospital a little differently, and it'll be hard to sort out what it really means.
So we'll have more ratings, but we wouldn't necessarily be better off than when we had no ratings?
Well, so I do think we're better off. I mean, again, I think my bias is more information is better, but there is such a thing as too much information, and there certainly is such a thing as too much conflicting information. You know, and we've done some work, and I've written about this, where we've tried to delve into why is it that different ratings give you different answers. And ultimately, they value different things. So there are some ratings, for instance, that really value mortality rates. You know, what are the chances that you're going to live or die if you go to that hospital?
That seems like an important one.
Yeah, so that's my favorite, actually. I actually think that's the most important one. It's very much a bottom line. Whereas other ratings might emphasize, you know, what are the chances that you'll be readmitted, or what are the chances that you'll have a good experience in the hospital? Again, things that are important, but I would personally put them lower down on the list. But different people might make different choices. What's hard is it's hard for consumers to figure out why is it that U.S. News is telling me this is a terrific hospital, whereas Consumer Reports might be telling me that this is a relatively mediocre one. That's hard for consumers to figure out.
Is there a way out?
Well, I'm hoping, you know, it's almost like we need a rating of ratings. I mean, we need some sort of a consumer guide that says, hey, tell us what you value. Tell us what's important to you. And then based on that, you can actually be pushed towards certain rating programs over others. So if you really care about patient safety, for instance, if you really care about avoiding being injured in the hospital, you'd probably go with the Leapfrog measures, which really emphasize patient safety. Mortality, if that's what's really at the top of your list, then U.S. News probably does a better job than anybody else. So there are these things, but it's hard to, until someone can help clarify that for the marketplace and for consumers, I think we're going to be in a little bit of a period of confusion.
How long will it be, do you think, before we're going to have a sensible sort of online dashboard that people will use customarily before they pick a doctor or a hospital or make a decision about where to put a loved one in a nursing home?
So I think we're going to see that relatively soon. I suspect in the next few years, we're going to see some other organization come in, a trusted third party that will really help patients and consumers make better decisions. You know, people are paying more out of pocket than they ever have before. People, I think, have come to realize that really makes a big difference which hospital you end up in. Actually, you know, your chances of living or dying from almost any condition is profoundly affected by which hospital you end up in. So this really matters. And what I think we're going to see in the next few years, and I don't know who will do it, but I can imagine some trusted third party really stepping in and providing a service for consumers that says, you know, tell us about what you value and we'll help you, using data, figure out where to go.
Ashish, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Ashish Jha from Harvard, who's helped us navigate the ratings game. Hi, I'm sitting here with Julie Robner, NPR's health policy correspondent. Hi, Julie.
Hey, Scott.
You went out to rural Virginia to do some reporting on how a consumer would figure out, is this a good hospital or a bad hospital? What'd you find? Can you remind me?
Yeah, well, it was this. I went out to Warrenton, Virginia, to Fauquier Hospital, and this was a hospital, a very patient-centered hospital. But I was, in doing my due diligence to find out whether this really was a high-quality hospital, I had a chance to look through some of those measures, you know, trying to stack it up compared to other hospitals. And I have to tell you, there's almost too much information now that's out there. There are so many different measures of hospitals, it really will make your eyes cross.
Did you talk to any patients?
The patients were all interested in the amenities.
They wanted good food.
They wanted good food. They wanted, you know, good visiting hours. They wanted to, you know, they wanted sort of this perception that the doctors there were good. They were looking to see, you know, whether they got sort of the touchy-feely kind of care. But, I mean, that's nothing to sneeze at. I mean, I think that's important, too. And that's the idea behind being, you know, sort of a patient-centered hospital, is that you're supposed to be able to do both. There's
right,
nothing
why
to
not?
Say. That's right. There's nothing to say that you can't be welcoming to your patients and provide high-quality care.
Now, I know another story that you've been working on. I'm hearing some of the calls wafting over the divider again, and it's this question of, if Romney's elected, can he follow through on his promise to undo the Affordable Care Act? And what is your reporting telling you?
Well, you know, it's the one thing that he's been really consistent about. Everywhere he goes, he says, and on day one, you know, I will act to repeal the Obamacare, the Federal Affordable Care Act. Turns out, as I've looked into it, not so easy.
What's the problem?
Well, first of all, when you push him on it, he knows it would take a while for Congress, even if he gets a Republican Congress, to actually repeal the law. So the first thing he says he'd do is he would give all 50 states a waiver so they wouldn't have to go forward with implementing it.
So what kinds of things are they on the hook for now?
Well, right now the states are supposed to be putting together these exchanges where people will go to shop for insurance starting next fall, really less than a year from now. And they don't have to do that. They actually have to tell the government whether they're going to do that sometime just
some
after.
Some are and some aren't.
Yeah,
right.
Some are and some aren't. But yeah, the states have a lot of things that they're supposed to be doing to gear up and get ready for this law. Well, it turns out that there's nowhere in the law that gives the president authority to tell states that they don't have to do any of the things that they're supposed to be doing.
So a waiver wouldn't cut it?
He's not allowed to do those waivers. The only waivers that there are, he's not allowed to do until the year 2017. And even then, if a state wants a waiver, they have to pledge they would cover as many people, as many uninsured people, as the law would otherwise. So those waivers that he's talking about, he could do them, but then somebody could march right into court and say, there's no authority in the law for you to do that. So that part's not going to work.
So one of the other things that we were talking about was that even if by some miracle or by some fiat, the law could be undone, there are things that have already taken effect or that the private sector has its own reasons for wanting to do. Could you help bring me up to speed on what some of those things are?
That's right. There's two things going on. One is that there are a lot of things that have already happened. It would be difficult to roll back. And even candidate Romney suggests that, things like allowing young people up to age 26 to stay on their health plan. And he points out, well, you don't need a federal law to do that because they're already doing that. Well, they're already doing that because they've been required by federal law to do it already. And they probably would keep it if the law went away. There are a lot of other insurance requirements that have already taken effect. Pre-existing conditions for children. There's no more annual limits on what insurance companies can pay out. There's no more
lifetime limits.
Lifetime limits are in the process of going away. there are now these rules that insurance companies have to pay a certain amount every year of each premium dollar or else give refunds. A lot
now
of people,
that one I remember.
A lot of people got refunds this year.
We got the refunded NPR.
That's right.
A really amazing effect.
It wasn't a big refund, but we all got a refund. So there, a lot of those things. But, I mean, the bigger issue is that a lot of things are going on behind the scenes for employers, insurers, hospitals, doctors to get ready for the big part of the implementation that starts in 2014. And there is a real concern, and I'm not just hearing this from Democrats, even some Republicans are worried that if you have a new Congress trying to take the law apart while you have the rest of the healthcare system scurrying to put the law together, you could have a real crisis going on
real
next
chaos.
Year. Yeah, serious chaos. And, you know, the question is only how much chaos is there going to be?
Well, we'll see what happens on Election Day and then go into Chapter 2 of what happens to the Affordable Care Act. But thanks a lot for explaining it to me.
You're welcome.
That's a wrap for the Shots podcast. Thanks for joining me. In case you hadn't figured it out by now, this was an experiment. Please let me know on the blog if you thought it was good or what we could do better, because I'd like to do it again. Thanks for listening.